From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on May 31st, 2012, when Manhattan District Attorney Cyrus Vance announced the indictment of a bank. Roughly 4 years after that full-blown financial collapse, someone in the banking world was getting charged. Vance said that everyone had learned important lessons from the financial crisis. Banking schemes can unravel, leaving taxpayers vulnerable. So who was it? Lehman Brothers? Bear Stearns? Maybe another big firm that created complex financial instruments that eventually detonated? No. Vance was there to announce the indictment of a small bank called Abacus Federal Savings of Chinatown. Abacus would be the only U.S. bank to face criminal charges in the wake of that crisis. The story is told in a film called Abacus by renowned filmmaker Steve James. Do you know James because of his film Hoop Dreams? And this weekend, Steve James is coming to Rochester. On Sunday, he'll receive the inaugural Double Take Vanguard Award at the One Take Film Festival. You can see two of his films, the aforementioned Abacus and Hoop Dreams. So the award's going to be presented at noon on Sunday at the Little Theater, just prior to the screening of Abacus. And post-screening, there will be a Q&A with Steve and Jack Garner. But first, we're honored to have the filmmaker Steve James with us on Connections. Steve, thank you for taking the time. How are you?
I'm good. Great to be here.
And also with us in studio is Professor Amit Badabiyal. He's a professor of economics, the Arthur J. Gosnell Professor of Economics at RIT. Professor Badabiyal, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me.
And you've had a chance to see the film as well here.
So. Yes, I have.
Well, so we've got a lot to talk about this hour. And Steve, your time is a little limited. So let me just start with you and ask you, first of all, how you first learned of the Abacus story. I mean, you were there kind of with this family as they went through a lot of this, but when did you get first turned on to it?
Well, we were there. We documented the trial, essentially, the time of the trial, you know, with the family. And I heard about it pretty soon before the trial began, and it was producer Mark Mitten, who was friends with the family for many years, who alerted me to this story and this trial that was imminent. And, you know, I didn't know anything about it, as most people didn't, because it wasn't a story that was really reported at all in the mainstream media to any degree.
There, the bank goes back to 1984, the Abacus Federal Savings Bank, founded by Thomas Sung, a Shanghai-born lawyer. And, you know, right from the start of the film, we see this family and this, I would use the word idealism, that they look at, you know, it's a wonderful life, and they think about what they can give back to their community. Did you view them in, you know, sort of authentically idealistic terms, Steve?
Absolutely. I mean, this bank has been a pillar in the Chinatown community in New York for, you know, going on three decades. And what prompted, you learn this in the film, but what prompted Thomas Sung to even start the bank up was recognizing that Chinese immigrants could not get the kind of service at U.S. banks. You know, they were happy to take their money as depositors, but were not happy to loan them money to build businesses or buy homes. And so he was a very successful lawyer. He didn't need to go into banking to remain successful, but he decided that that would be his mission, so he opened the bank. And that mission continues to today. And when you walk around the neighborhood with Thomas Sung, as we did in the course of making the film, you really see just how cherished he is in that community.
And so our listeners may be saying, well, then what the hell happened here? You know, and let me kind of lay it out, Steve, and correct me where I get it wrong, and then you can kind of pick up the ball from there. You know, you've got this case where at least one of the employees for the bank realizes some irregularities, and they kind of they figure out that something is going on in the mortgage books. They trace it back to an employee named Ken Yu, and they want to be, it seems to be, at least from the film, upfront about it. But then all of a sudden they find out, well, the government's going to be coming after all of them. The government's convinced that this is a sort of a systemic mortgage scam operation that they've got going, and that they're going to be targeted. They get sort of frog marched out. I mean, it becomes kind of a spectacle. So how did this all kind of go down?
Well, you got it right there. There's just a couple of details I'd like to add.
Yeah.
To it, which is that when they discovered that Ken Yu, this one loan officer, was engaged in fraud, including taking bribes from borrowers to help them get their loans through, you know, they were horrified, and they fired him pretty much immediately. And then they reported it to their regulators, which they're required to do. And then on top of that, which they're not required to do, they initiated their own internal investigation And from that, they found a couple of other employees that they thought were engaged in, you know, some fraud as well, and they got rid of them. Not on the level of Ken Yu, it must be said, but still engaged in fraud, and they got rid of them. So when the borrower came back to them in the original deal with Ken Yu and said, "I want my money," they weren't sure if this borrower was in collusion with Ken Yu, and so they said, "You should first go to the police." And so they sent this person to the police, and that launched into action the DA's office, first investigating Ken Yu, which the bank was cooperative about, and then it turned out that they seemed to be investigating the bank as a whole and thinking that they were engaged in widespread fraud and condoning and encouraging it. And that's when it became clear that they were the target. And so they were indicted in 2012. It came to trial in 2015. And the spectacle that you refer to is this, you know, when Vance announced the indictment, he chained together a number of former and present, but mostly former Abacus employees that they were accusing of fraud. They chained them together and marched them down the hallways for the press to photograph. And it was just, you know, it was a truly unforgivable spectacle. These were not violent criminals. It made no sense except as a photo op to say, "I'm being tough and I am going after a bank in the wake of this crisis."
There's Matt Taibbi, a reporter, the journalist, in the film, saying he's never really seen anything like it, and that yes, it looked like a spectacle for the purpose of sort of making a point, but let me also kind of key in on the title of the film. It's Abacus Small Enough to Jail. I mean, most of our listeners are familiar with the phrase "too big to fail," whether it's
right.
Andrew Ross Sorkin's book, or you know, just the idea that Wall Street firms had gotten so big and that instead of being prosecuted, they were bailed out. Well, here is this small bank that maybe they could be the target. You know, they're in Chinatown. They're going after them would not be quite the splash, but hey, at least we could say we went after somebody. And I want to hit two questions for you, Steve. First of all, when you look at what other banks were doing, when you look at the complex financial instruments, do you look at the way they chopped up subprime mortgages? They frankly signed off and underwrote a lot of mortgages that they should not have and then sort of hid that and sliced them up, knowing that eventually they would detonate. Yeah, the default rates got very high in a lot of different communities. The default rate for Abacus, according to your film, is not very high at all, right?
It's minuscule. That came out in the trial. Now, of the 3,000 loans that happened during the period of the indictment, and this is in the film, only 9 failed. What's not in the film is that Abacus default rate is 1/20th the national average. So, and they were not engaged in any of those vehicles, those credit default swaps and all those kinds of really spurious financial vehicles that, you know, that the big banks were doing. They didn't do any of that. They saw that for what it was and refused to be a part of that. So, you know, it really, in many respects, this bank was the mirror opposite of the big banks. They were the 2,651st largest bank in the country with, you know, minuscule assets compared to the big banks. They discovered fraud themselves and reported it and went above and beyond. Their loans didn't fail. You know, I mean, it really kind of boggles the mind. And I think that, you know, from Vance's perspective, and I can only, you know, I interviewed him, he's in the film, and he speaks for himself. But I think from their perspective, you know, with the big banks, they weren't in a position to bring charges against the big banks in New York City. That was a federal decision. So he wouldn't be in charge of whether to bring those charges or not. And, you know, there was decisions made in government to not prosecute those banks. But this one was one that he could bring. But when I asked him about comparing Abacus to the bigger banks, and this comment is in the film, he makes to me a very revealing comment. He says that, well, yes, some of the behavior of the big banks was less than ethical. And then he immediately goes on to say, but Abacus was engaged in some of that same behavior. And to me, to define what the big banks was as less than ethical falls far short of what the big banks were doing. And to tie Abacus to the big banks is ludicrous.
So, you know, in some sense, Vance, and it's great to have the DA, by the way, on camera. Getting the interview, I think, was huge for the film, and you get to hear him in his own words. He kind of comes off as a little bit of a villain in that way, but the point that you're making here, Steve, is an important one. It wasn't Vance saying, I'm going to prosecute Abacus and not Bear Stearns. I mean, that wasn't his realm. He went after Abacus, but he wouldn't have been the one to go after the big firms. Those were federal decisions. And I want to read something to you to kind of get a sense for whether you agree with it. Journalist and author David Dayan has written about the failure of our government to prosecute big banks. He's covered the foreclosure crisis more closer than probably anyone in this country. And he says progressives are too forgiving of the Obama White House. Here's what he writes about that. Quote, Obama inherited a bailout that he whipped Democrats to support while he was still a candidate. In office, he failed to overhaul or shrink a financial system that represents everything wrong with the modern economy. He didn't even stop the bonuses flowing at AIG. The government program Obama's Treasury Department built to mitigate foreclosures instead became a foreclosure creation machine. And no banker with any real agency in the crisis ever saw the inside of a jail cell in the most punitive nation on earth. Even when mortgage companies got caught falsifying mortgage documents in courts nationwide and stealing homes with false evidence, Obama's Justice Department made no effort to hold individuals responsible, end quote. Steve, do you share that sentiment?
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I think Obama was a terrific president in many respects. I think his administration failed in this respect. And I think, you know, you have to look at and I'm sure your other guest there is way more equipped to address this than me, without question. But, you know, you have to look a little bit at Eric Holder, too. Eric Holder came out of the banking, legally, he was involved with big banks much younger. He was involved with the Justice Department where when they came up, when he was a junior member, I believe, and he came up with the whole idea of collateral consequences. You know, this idea that when Arthur Andersen went down years ago, and with it, you know, thousands of employees lost their jobs, they came up with this idea of this sort of metric to decide whether to prosecute these large institutions as to whether the collateral consequences were too great. And you know, that concept has some real merit, but I think you see in this case with the big banks, it fell well short of doing the right thing. I'm with Neil Barofsky, who's in our film, who used to head up the TARP program. He thinks the big bank should have been broken up. Now, I'm not an economist, I'm not a banker, and maybe that was perceived as too extreme, but that's kind of where I come down on it.
And in our second half hour, we're going to dive much more with Professor Badabial into kind of current policy and where you see the landscape now and whether you've seen significant change or not. But Professor Badabial, I know you had a chance to see Abacus. Certainly not a bank that or a story that I had heard of. I don't know if you had until the film, but your first thoughts on it.
It's a well-made film, and I think the first thought that comes to my mind, having watched the entire film, is that D.F. Vance needed to have been seen to be doing something. So the something as well, let's catch relatively small fry who we can build a strong case around and hope that small fry will basically plead guilty or plead to something, something so that they won't actually have to go through with the trial. But the Sung family proved to be rather resilient, and they refused to buckle to this kind of pressure when, as is pointed out in the movie several times, they did nothing wrong, or at least that was their perception. So Vance had a fight on his hand, and eventually he ended up losing. So the overarching feeling I get from the DA's perspective is that, well, I got to do something, you know, and that something turned out to be nothing after the actual outcome was revealed.
And what about on the federal level here? You know, we'll spend more time in our second half hour talking about this subject. And listeners, if you want to weigh in, we'll talk about it with you as well. I read the quote from David Dayan, who's written so much about the foreclosure crisis. He said those were the real victims, the people who didn't get bailed out, the people who lost their homes. And federally, that was on that White House. That was on the Obama administration.
Well, absolutely. No question about that. But I'm not sure whether, you know, Vance could not have been more proactive by himself, because he's a U.S. attorney, you know. So he could have done things to influence matters in the Justice Department were he sufficiently interested. Like, compare his activities to, say, someone like Preet Bharara, who's been a lot more proactive in going after people for malfeasance of all sorts. But yes, you're absolutely right. The Obama administration, though generally a very good administration from my standpoint, on this particular issue, they did very little, if I mean, you could argue that in the grand scheme of the things, they almost did nothing. And the very big banks, these are the too big to fail banks, basically continued along their merry way.
Steve James, so for you, you made this film not only to tell the story of this family that I know you have a lot of affection for, the Sung family, but what do you want viewers to walk out of this of this viewing with, armed with, or at least feeling? You know, what's your hope as the filmmaker?
Well, I think there's a lot of things I hope they walk out with. I mean, among them, I hope, you know, this story, which could be considered just a footnote in the banking crisis stemming from 2008, I think is more than a footnote. I think it's very revealing, and it was an important story to tell because, you know, because it wasn't being told otherwise. Not right now, ma'am. I'm in a hotel room, and
that's okay. No problem. That's okay.
So, you know, I think that the failure of the mainstream media to even tell this story is something, and I'm glad we got the opportunity to do that. I do think I agree with Matt Taibbi in that this is an example of the unequal application of justice in this country, and it just so happens that you know, the Sungs were indeed not willing to buckle, take a plea deal. You know, they weren't even offered the same plea deals that the big banks were. They were offered agree to a felony and a fine, and then you're fine. You know, then you can walk away. But you know, and that just reveals that it was all about getting that conviction, and I think making something of, you know, of being the guy who had brought a bank to its heels in the wake of this crisis. I mean, federal justice people behind him when he announced the indictment. It was all connected to that, and so you know, I think that this is an important story to tell in that regard, and the Sungs were just not willing to give up. You know, the fact that they were willing to put their money, millions of dollars. These were not poor people, which usually are the people who are most victimized by the unequal application of justice. They were not that, and thank God, because they were able to effectively fight back. And I think the other thing that's really important to me in this story is, as a profile of this very resilient and courageous and quite entertaining family. You know, it's a portrait of Chinese Americans that I am told by a number of Chinese Americans who have attended screenings at festivals and such that they just haven't seen, and they're really glad to see, you know, in a film, because we have such sort of rigid stereotypes about what it means to be a Chinese American in this country.
And Steve, let me also ask you about some of the chatter about this film and about the activity of the DA and maybe some of the motivations. There have been questions on whether the motivations were based on ethnicity, based on race. And Stephen Dalton reviewed the film for Hollywood Reporter. Here was his conclusion after watching your film. He writes, quote, "Some accuse the DA's office of racial bias, but the evidence does not really stand up. It appears more likely that the Sung family were singled out because they were an easy target rather than for their ethnic origins," end quote. Do you agree with that, Steve?
Well, I agree that I don't think the DA's office sat down and said, "We're going after this Chinese American bank, you know, and for overtly racist reasons." I mean, that kind of racism, it still goes on in this country to an appalling degree, but it doesn't go on to the degree it once did. Racism in this country has transformed to much more subtle, and often is the case. The people who are engaged in doing culturally insensitive or racially insensitive acts are unaware of their own motives in it and the ways in which they are doing that. And I think that's what was going on here. I think that the trial as a whole shows a profound lack of understanding and sensitivity to what it means to be an immigrant in this country working in a cash economy and trying to get a foothold and mortgage loans to become more, you know, middle-of-the-road, regular U.S. citizens, which is the process that's happened in this country going back decades and decades. And the prosecution showed no inclination towards sensitivity or care about that at all. I think it's commented on in the film that if this had been a African-American bank and they had thought about chaining these employees together and marching them down the hall, someone probably before it happened would have said, you know, that's not really good optics here, you know, thinking back on the history of this country. They might not have done it, right? But in this case, they did it with impunity. They chained them together and marched them down the hall, not aware at all at what that meant for the Chinese-American community in terms of how they viewed that. So I think the insensitivity and racism was more deeply embedded and not on the surface, which is, I think, is what that reviewer is referring to.
That was a remarkable scene. The film is Abacus, Small Enough to Jail. You can see it, and as we get ready to let Steve go, you can see it at noon at the Little Theater this coming Sunday. It's part of the One Take Film Festival. Hope you're checking out the selections there. They're doing great work there. And what I want to ask Steve before he goes is this here. You know, you're coming in. They're going to show Abacus, Small Enough to Jail. They're going to show Hoop Dreams. You can't get away from Hoop Dreams. I know, you know, that's been such a great success and hailed since its release in 1994. You're going to be receiving the initial Double Take Vanguard Award at the One Take Film Festival. And they are so, I mean, I've talked to the organizers of the festival. They are so excited you're coming, and they're so proud to give you that award. I know you've been probably around the world, Steve, and probably honored in many, many different ways. But what does that mean to you?
Well, I mean, it's great to have, you know, the body of my work recognized by this award. I mean, yes, Hoop Dreams is by far my most, you know, popular film. But, you know, I've been doing this, I've been making a lot of films over the years since Hoop Dreams, Abacus being the latest, but a lot of them in between. And so I look at awards like this as an award for a body of work, not just one or two. And so I appreciate it. It means a lot.
And Steve is going to have a conversation with Jack Garner after the screening of Abacus, Small Enough to Jail. What has the Sung family told you about the film?
Well, they're very happy with the film. You know, I think they feel like that we really told the story fairly and accurately. But more than that, you know, they feel like this story has something larger to say to viewers and to their community, the Chinese-American community, about standing up and being heard and pushing back. And that's, I think, the thing that makes them most proud to have been a part of it, because they feel like this can have greater impact than just, you know, telling their story and exonerating their bank.
And Steve, I know you mentioned, you know, you're not an economist, you're not a professor of economics like Professor Badabiel, but clearly you are a tremendous filmmaker and a concerned citizen. So as we close this chapter of the financial collapse, I'm not sure it's closed yet, do you look around and say, boy, they tried to go after Abacus and the Sung family, everyone else kind of walked, are you worried that what happened in 2008 is sort of ripe to happen again?
Well, again, I am not equipped to address that, really, but I keep reading where there is concern by economists that we are ramping back up because the underlying problems, the underlying structural problems, weren't addressed, and we could very well find ourselves back. You know, it probably won't be a mortgage crisis, but it will be you know, another kind of crisis. And that does concern me. You know, that was a very scary time.
The film is Abacus, Small Enough to Jail. Steve James will be in Rochester to accept that award and to be there for the screening on Sunday at the Little Theater. We'll see you then. And Steve, thank you so much for taking the time for the program today.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
All right. A short break on Connections. We continue. And if you want to join the discussion, we're going to talk to Professor Badabiel about some of these themes that we've been raising with Steve James and that his film has raised as well. You know, you just heard him saying he's not an expert, but he is concerned that are we moving back into a territory of putting the banks in sort of an over-leveraged position or putting the financial system in a potential crisis? Did we respond effectively enough to what happened? And what's sort of the current state of things? I bet you we've got plenty to talk about with Professor Badabiel, but if you want to join the program, you can do that. It's 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free. 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994. We're right back. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Professor Badabiel, we're going to start right with where Steve James left off. you know, he's a filmmaker. He's not an economist, but he's worried that we didn't learn our lessons, that we're going to set the financial system up for more banking possible collapse, or at least more pain, the likes of which we saw almost a decade ago now. Wow. Let's start there. Are you concerned?
Yes, I am. And I think the general principle that I would like to outline, and it's not just limited to banks, it permeates our thinking in pretty much every policy circle that one can think about, is that we have created an incentive system in which the benefits from undertaking risky action typically flow to private owners. And the benefits are captured by private entities. But the losses, when these people screw up for whatever reason, rightly or wrongly, the losses tend to be socialized. As a result, it's typically people on Main Street who often end up holding the losses, but they share no part in the decision-making that leads to the decision-making that creates profits or benefits in the first place. So this asymmetry is the broad problem in our economy. And banks are one particular aspect of this particular principle that is applied to a particular sector.
All right, so I think I want to look back a little and talk a little bit more about what the Obama administration did or did not do regarding banks. And then I want to try to reflect on what we've at least seen so far when it comes to possible policies, regulation, maybe lessening of regulation in banking under the Trump administration. We mentioned, you know, and you shared your feelings that maybe the Obama administration could have been done more to prosecute. There's two different things in play, I think, Professor, and tell me if I'm wrong here. It's one thing to say they should break up the banks, and it's another to say keep the banks, but prosecute the people at the top or the people who were found to have created these instruments that were they knew to be toxic and put them in jail. You could have done one without the other, yes?
That's right. That's right. And I think a lot of people are concerned, even angry, that the second alternative wasn't picked up on adequately. That is, you don't necessarily, you know, have to toss the baby out with the bathwater. You can do limited cleaning and particularly holding certain sets of individuals who should have known better, but, you know, threw caution to the wind and hold them accountable for their actions. But, you know, Evan, the problem that tends to arise in these kinds of scenarios is if you're going after somebody, say, at Goldman Sachs, he, she, or they will have an army or a battalion of lawyers basically helping them out and trying to basically, you know, stymie every investigative action that the government needs to undertake to basically present a credible case. So the problem that the government runs into is that it's going to have to put tremendous amount of resources into holding a relatively small number of crooks, or at least alleged crooks, accountable. But at the same time, some of the information that they need to hold these people accountable, they are reliant on the banks to give them the information. So the SEC is generally understaffed, and they don't quite have the volume of resources to go after several big fish at these banks and investment banking institutions. So that's the basic problem. And to that, you have to add the last bit. Okay, so if we go after some of these people, what is going to be the employment impact on everyday Joe Schmo? Are we going to see 300 people laid off because we went after two people? Well, maybe that's a cost-benefit trade-off that the government is unwilling to accept.
Okay. And I'm also wondering if, you know, you look back at what the country was going through. The new president comes in, Barack Obama comes in. We are in a crisis. The Dow's at 6,000. You know, I mean, it's remarkable how bad things were. And with more distance, I think it's easy for us to start forgetting how rough things were.
That's right.
So maybe, you know, and I don't mean to sound like an apologist for him because I'm trying to be appropriately scrutinizing, but perhaps he's looking at this saying, if I start putting a bunch of people in jail from Wall Street or talking about breaking up the banks, I think he probably would have told you, my goal is to stabilize, whatever that takes. We have to stabilize the financial system. Enough people have lost so much in their savings, their 401ks. We've got to stabilize. And my efforts are not going to be putting people in jail right now. My efforts are going to be to stabilize so we can kind of get up and start healing. I think you probably could have walked and chewed gum at the same time. But is it easy to forget just how rocky things were?
I think there is some of that. I mean, it's easy to forget how complicated things were. And I essentially agree with the thrust of what you're saying. But to that, I would add the following. Remember the auto bailout? the automobile industry in this particular country was in dire straits. And if the Obama administration hadn't bailed them out, there is a very strong likelihood that we would see none of the big three in existence today, or at least not in the sense we have typically come to see them. So the auto bailout took out a lot of resources of government time, human resources, and that I think needs to be looked into account because these things were happening contemporaneously.
Okay, and I'm going to grab our first phone call, but before I do that, I mean, look, the show's not about me, but I will share, if anybody's sitting there going, well, you're a real apologist for Obama, I will say I think history is going to be judging it to be a mistake not to even try to prosecute the people at the top or the people who were culpable in the creation of these instruments. I think it sent the wrong signal. And that is, as Ahmed is saying, we're not talking about necessarily breaking up the banks. That's a separate discussion. But the fact that they really didn't even try did send a real signal to Wall Street and, frankly, a signal to Main Street that I suspect President Obama will grow to regret if he doesn't regret already. But, you know, that's just the observation of a layman. So let me just grab our first phone call, and this is Jane in Rochester. Go ahead, Jane.
Yes, Evan, with Obama, I'm going to say he was very new in the presidency to be dealing with such a terrific problem at the very beginning, and it was a lot to handle. But I feel like he probably was damned if he jailed and damned if he didn't.
That's probably right.
You know, but what I'm concerned about is it's been said hundreds of years ago that sometimes people learn nothing and they forget everything. So we've been down this road before, and I understood that the Glass-Steagall was strengthened by Obama. Dodd-Frank, the Consumer Bureau, Protection Bureau, I'd like to know the status of those three things, which were in the news quite a bit, and I think Donald Trump is doing or has done as much as he can to undo what Obama accomplished in strengthening those. So if you would talk about that and how it pertains to the risk that we now have of making the same mistakes again. Thank you.
All right, Jane, thank you very much for that. So let's just talk about some of the specific things that she's talking about, Professor Badabial, and then we can look at what we might expect to happen next under our Trump administration.
Right. Okay, so the caller talked about some of the actions that President Obama took under his watch and the fact that, you know, he was a relative neophyte. I mean, that's certainly true, and you can make the case that, you know, there was a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation. But, you know, picking up on a theme that you were mentioning before the caller called in is that it would not have been, at least from my perspective, unsound policy to pick out one or two individuals from each of the major banking institutions and go after them big time. Just one or two people in the hope that you're going to make an example out of these people. But what they ended up doing, well, not they, District Attorney Vance ended up doing is the opposite thing. You know, they went after a relatively small bank and said, okay, we're going to make an example out of you. That's having the problem exactly, you know, the inverse way that I would look at it. You need to go after the really big fish and make some people accountable, them, hold them accountable in a way so that you have a credible signaling device to other people. You know, what is it, the 2,651st bank? Well, going after them, that's not going to do anything.
Yeah.
The other point is the issue of risk. And this, too, I would like to link with the movie since we're discussing that. What was the basic, I mean, there were several counts, of course, in the DA's allegations about what the bank did, that is Abacus. But one of the key problems that they had was that the bank was selling risky mortgage loans to Fannie Mae. And that the risk that should have been borne by the bank was in some sense being transferred to Fannie Mae, even though Fannie Mae did not know the entire deal and the entire numbers that went along with it. This is a key problem. And the risk aspect of this particular story is very closely related to something that I mentioned earlier on. That is, if you make a $1 million bet with $1 in your pocket, if you win, you get to collect all of the rewards. Nobody else, you get to collect it. But if you make a $1 million bet with $1 in your pocket and your bet goes south, then the government, that is all of us, come in to bail you out. That's the fundamental problem. And many of those banks knew that if push came to shove, they would in fact be bailed out. That's why this, you know, created a culture of excessive risk-taking, because they knew, hey, nothing's going to happen to us, because if everybody collapses, then Uncle Sam's here to bail us out. And that implicit assurance that they had encouraged too much risk-taking, and that's one of the things that we should have gone after, and we haven't, as far as I'm aware.
Yeah, and so that's why when you start to hear of these numbers, these ratios, that these banks were leveraged at 30 to 1, 35 to 1, yeah, that's what it means. I mean, you make a $1 bet or a $35 bet with a dollar in your pocket there, and all of a sudden, when people come to collect, you're in trouble. Well, the taxpayers are in trouble if they have to bail you out. I what I'm hearing, Professor, is that the banks are not leveraged quite so severely, but it's also not quite as comfortable as we'd like it to, I think everybody would like it to be. And then the question going forward is, what do we expect in terms of regulation under this administration? You know, the caller, Jane, was concerned that some of what she saw as progress in terms of regulation would be undone. What do we think?
Right. I'm not very optimistic that we're going to see a very consumer-oriented behavioral approach from the present administration. Because if you look at the appointments that he's made, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, and in particular, say, the Treasury Secretary, Mr. Mnuchin, these are all people from, you know, the banking establishment. They're part of the old boys network. So it's difficult for me to believe that they're actually going to do much that is going to be significantly helpful to your average Joe Schmo on the street, on Main Street. So when you combine with that the fact that there seems to be a crisis a day as far as the current administration is concerned, we have no idea what's going to happen. Maybe nothing will happen. I mean, the current emphasis seems to be on repeal and replace Obamacare, but that's stuck right now given Mr. Trump's most recent activities with respect to firing the FBI. So I'm not very hopeful that we're going to see a whole lot until the immediate chaotic environment we find ourselves in settles down somewhat. And even then, we might not see much that is consumer-oriented and designed to keep your average American in mind and not the big banks.
Yeah, right now, certainly you could say the Republican Party and then a large core of the Democratic Party is pretty pro-Wall Street, or, you know, pretty cozy with Wall Street. And you had this candidate, Donald Trump, running for office, who was advised by Reince Priebus, who's sort of in with that Republican mainstream, very pro-Wall Street. And then you have Steve Bannon, who, you know, is sort of only lacking like a hook nose and like a bag of money in one hand and the world in the other. He wants to blow everything up. You know, I mean, like that's, he has said he wants disruption. He wants to break the system. So I don't think Bannon, even though he came from Wall Street, is in these days, in his current iteration, very pro-Wall Street. But all I'm trying to do is forget who's advising him, forget what Donald Trump says, and judge what he does and who he has been appointing.
Right.
I mean, look at Mnuchin's record. You want to talk about people getting foreclosed because there was an accidental decimal point wrong on a payment. I mean, just unbelievable stories of foreclosure that, I try not to overstate it, heartless foreclosure. Mnuchin was part of that, and here he is. So it's hard to look at the appointments and say, yes, this is a direction that says we're going to be protecting consumers, we're going to be protecting Main Street, even at the expense of Wall Street. It doesn't look like that.
No, and you think back to President Obama's time. His first Treasury Secretary was Tim Geithner, who came from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. And, you know, people were asking questions about Geithner. Well, he's from the Federal Reserve Bank in New York. All these big bankers are his buddies. He regularly socializes with these people. How hard is he going to push against those banks? Well, looked at now with some hindsight, with the current Treasury Secretary, it seems even less likely that anything significant is going to happen that has a consumerist perspective to it.
Jeffrey emails the program to say, oh, let me pull this back up. Evan, the idea of prosecuting bankers is anti-capitalist. Banks are just part of the system, and the problem is the government. If anything, the Obama administration should have been prosecuting people from the inside. They're the ones who caused the crisis. Professor Vadabiel?
Well, I'd like to know who exactly from the inside should be prosecuted, because I'm not aware of any wrongdoing or certainly not any criminal action within the Obama administration that would call for prosecution. Having said that, it is true, as the caller suggests, that bankers are part of the system, but it's a system that we have created. Just because they're a part of the system doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, we should give them a, you know, carte blanche to do basically whatever they want. We regularly prosecute politicians. They're part of the system. We regularly prosecute gamblers or people trading on inside information. That's part of the system. So we have a set of laws, but those laws need to be equally applied irrespective of one's station in life. But I think the problem is that a lot of people perceive that there is one set of laws that apply to very big bankers and another set of laws that apply to, you know, your regular Main Street resident. That basic inequities is what I think bothers a lot of people.
All right, because I got you here and we're hitting on some of these broader themes, I want to ask you some questions that I think will help me understand from your perspective as a professor of economics how you view the health of the economy. You know, it's one thing to look at the Dow, and that's probably oversimplified. What we've learned certainly in the last 8 years, the Obama administration, you can argue, help stabilize a very fraught economy and financial system. And certainly the Dow grew and was very, very healthy under the Obama administration. But that doesn't mean that wages grew. So what are the benchmarks that you're looking at before you say, yeah, look, the economy is, quote unquote, doing better or is healthy?
Right. So as far as the financial indices are concerned, I typically pay a lot more attention to the S&P 500 than to the Dow or the NASDAQ. Because it's a much broader index, so hence more representative broadly of the market and what the market is doing than the Dow, which is just basically 30.
Why do we stick with the Dow? Why do so many of us are still addicted to the Dow?
I think there's some historical appeal. It's probably the first big index that Americans started looking at as a harbinger of what's happening in the stock market generally. So there's some psychological love for the Dow, which has transcended many generations.
Hey, we still talk about batting average in baseball, and it's meaningless. So you're right. It takes a while. It takes a while. Okay, so the S&P is a better market.
Yeah, the S&P is definitely a much broader 500, as the name suggests, a much broader barometer of what's happening in the market generally. So that's something that I look at. But another key statistic that I look at are the unemployment numbers and what's happening to wage growth. I think the significant problem is that even though we're seeing decreases in unemployment, which is a good thing, we're not seeing the kind of wage growth that people would like to see. So companies, Apple is a good example, are still hoarding lots of cash. They're sitting on cash and not necessarily investing that either in new products or new processes. We'd like to see more of that. So the combination of on the financial side, the S&P 500, and the more real side, the unemployment numbers combined with information about wage growth are the three things that I look at. Of course, with inflation, but inflation is much less of a problem in the United States than, say, it's historically been in other parts of the world.
Now, the last time you and I talked about UBI, a universal basic income, your feeling was that we've many times throughout our history said that the sky is falling, that mechanization, that the horse and buggy industry is going to go under, and what are we ever going to do with those jobs? Well, those jobs became... people did other things because the economy shifts, but that shift doesn't necessarily wipe out jobs. And the last time Professor Badabial was here, we had a panel discussing Elon Musk's comments about mechanization, automation, and maybe we're at the tipping point. Now, we're not necessarily there, but my colleague down the hall, Veronica Volk from Great Lakes Today, she said, you got to listen to the Weeds Ezra Klein's group's podcast. Their newest edition is on the UBI, and she said, I haven't listened to it yet, but I'm going to listen because Veronica says to listen, and I listen to whatever podcast she says to listen to.
Okay.
One of the issues that comes up is globalization. Globalization comes up in every election. It came up with Brexit. We saw it in the French election. We saw it in this election. I know, Professor, you've talked about the fact that we communicate very poorly about the benefits of trade. But what are the lessons that you have seen in the last year about globalization and about whether we can expect jobs to come back? Here's why I asked. When you say wages, unemployment may be going down, but wages are not coming back up. That says to me people lost jobs in certain sectors, maybe were out of work for a while. They're now working again, but they're not replacing their wages because they're probably doing something else that wasn't maybe what they were trained to do, and maybe there aren't jobs that pay to that level because of automation or certain things. I may be over-extrapolating, but tell me your thoughts on that.
Okay, so about globalization. So unless you're, a country like North Korea, basically don't participate in the world economy, globalization is not something that you can fight, or you can try to fight it at your own peril, meaning nations. So it's a question of how best do you make sure that you can tap into the advantages, because there are many, of globalization. Now, we have a lot of data now which shows us what the impacts of globalization have been on both workers in the United States and in many other countries of the world, such as, say, large developing countries like China and India. And I think most economists would generally say that globalization or openness, trade as one aspect of openness, has disproportionately benefited very large numbers of people in countries like China and India, no question. However, globalization has also hurt American workers and middle-class Americans in a way that very few could foresee. And when you come to a sector like manufacturing, and in the context of trade, sectors where we typically the sector competes with imports coming in from foreign countries, workers there have been decimated in a big way. There's no question about that. And many of these folks who have been adversely affected by the forces of globalization, a significant part, though not an exclusive part, of which is trade with China, have seen significant declines in their standards of living, and successive slews of politicians promising this or that, but really not delivering. And my conjecture, and with some evidence, is that this is a significant body of people who are supporters of President Trump, who think that traditional politicians have failed us. They always promise things at election time, but then they really do nothing. But the fact of the matter is, over 30, 40 years, with trade with China and globalization more generally, we are really being adversely affected. And what do we do? So this affected group is the core economic base of Donald Trump in terms of his supporters.
Are they
wrong? No, they're not. No, they're not. And that's why when we look at why Donald Trump won and what kind of Americans are going to sustain his presidency, that is, continue to support him, we have to understand that there is a significant economic element to these disaffected voters who think traditional politicians have failed them.
Yeah.
And hey, why not try something new? How much worse could it get?
That's why, and again, talk about extrapolating at the risk of doing it here, but that's why you wonder, look at all the polls, look at these efforts go back and talk to Trump voters. They're not moving. They're still happy with him. They rate him 8, 8.5, 9, 10 out of 10. They don't care about, I don't want to speak for everybody. They don't generally care about Russia. They don't care about what a lot of people perceive as scandals because they still feel like the economy's broken and that the traditional politicians broke it. They gave up on manufacturing too early and they want it back. Now, it may not be coming back, but did we give up on manufacturing too easily? Should we have been more protectionist?
Well, I don't think we should have been too protectionist, because the thing is, if you are a major player, as we are in the international arena, then we subscribe to a set of treaties and agreements which govern our behavior, not only in the international trade dimension, but across the whole host of international activities. Now, there are secular forces at work that were gradually eating away at manufacturing and led to the gradual demise of manufacturing, which has something to do definitively with the rise of countries like India and China. That's not something that you can basically fight. I mean, you can, but it's not clear that the costs would justify the benefits. Along with that, you have to see the other phenomena that's a big part of the American economy, that is skill-biased technological change. So skill-biased technological change has helped certain segments of the population who possess the skills and are hence able to leverage these technologies far more than your average worker who simply does not possess the skills. So the combination of the forces of globalization along with skill-biased technological change has meant manufacture typically has been in the losing side of the story as far as globalization generally is concerned. And, you know, workers in this sector have legitimate grievances. There's no question about that. But of course, mixed in with them are a bunch of unsavories, adding to the potpourri of complications in terms of separating out, well, whose claims are legitimate and whose are not.
Sure. And down to our last couple of minutes, but one of the ideas gaining some steam among Bernie Sanders supporters, writers like Matt Stoller, is the idea that that we have not been aggressive enough in utilizing antitrust, that we've allowed too much concentration, too many mergers, too little competition because of big, big power, and that doesn't always bestow the same benefits for consumers or for workforces. If we were more aggressive with antitrust, that would help the economy. What do you think?
I think there's some truth to that when applied to certain sectors of the economy. But I wrote an op-ed article about precisely this point in the Rochester Business Journal, I think it was 2 weeks ago, in which I argue that there are some reasons why you would want to let mergers go ahead.
For example,
so the idea here is that in an industry in which there is one dominant player, example Microsoft or Intel in the computer chip sector, there are many small firms who are basically doing a lot of good work in terms of promoting innovation and creativity. But these firms, once they reach a certain critical threshold, often get bought up by the dominant players. So that's part of a merger. But then these kinds of mergers arise because the most promising small players with their most promising products or processes are now part of a bigger firm. And this is a good thing because it provides additional variety to consumers, whatever the underlying object might be, and often at a lower cost. So the point is that there are certain sectors of the economy in which mergers should be allowed to go through because of these counterintuitive reasons. That is, they don't lessen competition, but they actually promote competition because of this effect of smaller firms wanting to join or wanting to be a part of the big firm. But across the board, it's a sector-specific perspective. In certain sectors, it's absolutely true, but in others, not so much.
The Comcast Time Warners of the world?
That's right.
That's a one where maybe there's not as many benefits?
That's right. That should be looked at very closely.
Okay. Professor Badabiel, I always learn from you. I always enjoy having you on the program. Thanks for taking the time to come in, and I hope we can talk to you soon.
That's great, Evan. Thanks very much for having me.
And just a reminder to our listeners, Steve James, the filmmaker behind Abacus, Small Enough to Jail, is going to be in Rochester on Sunday at the Little Theater, a noon showing of Abacus. There's going to be a nice little award ceremony there. He is going to be presented with the inaugural Double Take Vanguard Award for the One Take Film Festival, which I know you're attending at the Little Theater. As they roll out these wonderful films. Well, Abacus, and then Hoop Dreams, and Steve James is going to be there with Jack Garner for a discussion, so they'll see you there on Sunday. I'll see you tomorrow. Our thanks to Rob Braden. Megan Mack is the producer. Kat Schwarz hanging out with us today. Always great to see Kat, and we'll be right back with you on Friday.